Hi everyone, my name is Eugenia Chow and I run the Instagram account Ugreenia. The Everyday Activist podcast is founded under the belief that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to activism and anyone can get involved. Tori Tau is an intersectional climate activist and mental health advocate based in Bristol. An unapologetic Eurasian, she was raised in Hong Kong and has since then worked with Stella McCartney, participated in Sail to the COP, and recently spent months in Colombia facilitating a project called Sail for Climate Action. In this episode, we discuss the role of mental health in climate activism, how to be a better ally, coping with eco-anxiety, setting boundaries, microaggressions, and growing up mixed race. I had a ton of fun recording this conversation with Tori, so I hope you will enjoy this episode as much as I did. Hi, Tori, and welcome to the Everyday Activist podcast. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I'm really glad that we could work out the time difference.
Yeah, for sure. So firstly, could you please tell us a bit about your background, what inspired you to get involved with climate activism, and how did growing up in Hong Kong shape your environmental narrative?
Yeah, sure. So I identify as an intersectional climate activist, and it's funny because a lot of people think that this journey was very short in regards to like since moving to the UK, but I was very involved in environmental initiatives in Hong Kong and also within, you know, a school capacity. I grew up in like new territories in Hong Kong, which is quite rural in many respects. And, you know, I had an affinity for nature growing up. I would spend most of my weekends hiking or you know, just spending in time in nature. And that definitely gave me an appreciation for that. But I would say that my environmental consciousness really started becoming stronger when I was learning about climate change in school, also learning about sort of trafficking trade in Hong Kong, especially wild pet trade, and also like different sorts of, you know, things like shark fin and also pangolin and all of these things that, you know, unfortunately that part of the world is known for. And I remember joining an initiative which was in partnership with the Hong Kong Shark Finning Foundation. And that kind of really got me thinking about whether I wanted to study conservation or biology at university. So I ended up studying in the UK and I did my master's in the UK as well, which was in ecology and conservation. And I think it was around about like 3 or 4 years ago, I had a PhD lined up and I was pretty sure I wanted to go into research until I thought, you know what, I'm going to take a year out because I've just gone from my undergrad to my master's to then doing a PhD. I think I need some time to just chill out a bit. Mm-hmm. And I used that time to go traveling and to really figure out what I wanted to do. And I realized that my priority was kind of in communication, and I was more interested in communicating science than actually researching it. So from that sort of trajectory, I started thinking about science communication and wildlife filmmaking, which is why I moved to Bristol in the UK. But as I spent more and more time within this realm of wildlife filmmaking, I realized that so much of what I actually wanted to talk about was not the pretty stuff, not the beautiful wildlife documentaries that you see on television, not the captivating stories that make people fall in love, which sounds really depressing, but I have a penchant for talking about things that people don't want to talk about, the things that aren't pretty, things that make you feel uncomfortable, and quite frankly, a lot of things that are really depressing. And with time, I found myself speaking about climate-related issues alongside biodiversity loss, but then also as a sort of broad, you know, justice issue with regards to racial equality and also with regards to representation and feminism and all of these things that really play into the climate movement. So it's kind of evolved with time, but I would say that, yeah, I definitely had an affinity for environmentalism growing up in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm.
Was the initiative with like the Shark Fin initiative the first climate related thing that you got involved with, or like what other things were you a part of in school?
Yeah, so there are two organizations within school that I was involved with. One of them was sort of like a senior leadership team, and it comprised pretty much some of the leadership team in school alongside some student representatives, and It was an environmental management committee of ways of getting our school to lower its carbon footprint and be more green. And, you know, we would relay information as representatives to our year group and also feedback these ideas with the leadership team. And then there was also another initiative I was part of, which was called 10%, which was trying to reduce the light and energy bills of the school by 10%. So they kind of fed into each other quite nicely. But, you know, it's very interesting to think that back then our whole focus was on like energy bills and light bills. And, you know, there was no discussion about like the impact of our food consumption on our carbon footprint, or there was no talk about like kind of things that we would do outside of school to reduce our carbon footprint. It was very much like within school, we're just going to reduce our energy bills. That was like our thing.
Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, you talked about how you prefer to document the uglier side of climate-related issues. Do you think you're more galvanized by the idea of preserving the beauty of nature or preventing it from further catastrophe? So, like, are you mobilized by the positive aspects of it or preventing the negative aspects of it?
Yeah, definitely. I would say a bit of both, but I would lean more to the latter side. There was a lot that I used to celebrate with regards to nature, and I was very, very consumed by making sure that, you know, everything that I did came from a place of love. But then I realized that so much of what happens in the world can't necessarily be tackled with all of this really like soft, loving approach to activism. Mm-hmm. And I also think, you know what, I'm going to amend that saying that my sort of love for the environment comes from a place of a lot of the time anger and frustration, and I try and capitalize on those emotions to do what I consider good with the world and to do things that, you know, aren't necessarily the pretty things, the things that aren't necessarily as palatable, the things that make people feel quite frustrated and scared. And as I've spent more and more time thinking about it, the more I realize that you can turn the things that make you uncomfortable and upset into action. And it's been really therapeutic, especially for me with like different mental health problems, and like especially a large part of my mental health being dominated by eco-anxiety. Mm-hmm. I find that, yeah, tackling these things really helps me.
Yeah, I guess building on that, how do you usually cope with eco-anxiety?
Ooh, yeah, it's a big topic. Uh-huh. But a really good question. I would say, yeah, direct action used to be kind of my go-to. Attending protests, being part of communities and groups that were really concerned about the climate crisis, not only because you're taking action, but because you have a support network that gets where you're coming from and people who understand this feeling of feeling anxious and terrified about what's going to happen, what's happening now, actually, and what's going to happen in the future. And that was something I really, really resonated with. And as I started taking to Instagram, for instance, and Twitter for talking about climate issues, I found a community online as well. And that was really therapeutic. And then I started to realize that, you know, direct action and protesting is one form of activism that not everybody has access to, not everybody feels comfortable doing. And it started making me think about the inclusivity of the Global North's climate movement, especially within the UK. And I started thinking, okay, well, you know, I would say social media is generally more accessible to some people than direct action. And so I started cultivating a space online, I guess, where I would talk about different issues. And that really helped me with my anxiety and panicking about, you know, what the world will be like in the future. And really sharing those feelings as well online. I'm very unapologetic with how I feel, and I have no fears being vulnerable online or talking about these things, because I feel like so many people are scared and so many people are worried. And the second you start talking about it, it almost destigmatizes the eco-anxiety that exists. And one more thing is, when I was talking to somebody a few weeks ago about the concept of eco-anxiety, I started unpacking the fact that I think eco-anxiety is kind of a bit of an umbrella term these days. There are so many different forms of, you know, eco mental health that you can experience, like eco rage or eco depression, anxiety, you know, all of these different things. And kind of making sense of those individual moods and emotions and mental health issues has been super helpful for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you've talked quite a bit about how you've been recently diagnosed with borderline personality disorder on your Instagram page. How could you talk a bit about how this has affected you and also your climate activism work?
Yeah, definitely. You know, borderline personality disorder has a really large stigma attached to it because any form of personality disorder conjures up these images of someone who's like, you know, slightly, I don't know, has multiple personalities or has like different mind states or hallucinates and all of these things. And to be very honest, mental health conditions definitely conjure up those sorts of imageries, but they can also exist in different mental health conditions as well. So that's not necessarily to say that it's a stigma. But with borderline personality disorder, I think a lot of people are a little bit terrified of what it means and may perceive me differently in a way that's not necessarily on par with what it actually entails. I think, you know, borderline personality disorder, I think the number one thing that I would say characterizes it is sensitivity. And I used to see sensitivity as such a huge weakness. Especially, I don't know if you can relate to this, growing up in Hong Kong, you know, my mom is Cantonese and so much of her, and to be honest, my dad as well, so much of their parenting was very much like dictated by tough love and like just get on with it. And like, you know, this idea of, oh, stop complaining, just like, you know, everything's fine, you're very lucky. I had a hard childhood. My mom would always say that. And it's, yeah, it's very real for a lot of people who grew up in Hong Kong. And, you know, I can see that my parents were very well-meaning and they did care. And that was their way of showing love. And a lot of people in the UK would definitely not agree with that. But I think we need to like take on board the generational aspects and the cultural perceptions of our families as well. You know, it was kind of through interacting with them that I realized I have a huge amount of sensitivity. For me, it's, I very, very much feel things to the core. Like the work that I do, I take very personally. When I see animal suffering or people suffering, like it really shakes me to my core to the point where I feel like I can empathize. And the way that I kind of describe it, or psychologists describe it, is in my case being an intuitive empath, which means that I'm very aware of my own emotions and very aware of those people around me and how their emotions can really affect mine as well. And borderline personality disorder for me is characterized by the fact that if somebody hurts me or if somebody does something that is really, you know, not meant to be intentionally hurtful, I still feel the effects of that. And, you know, I think that my borderline personality disorder is partly genetic, but I think a large part of it is environmental. The tough love my parents gave me growing up actually made me more like, more sort of keen and hopeful for receiving this sort of affection and like receiving validation from people. And I realized that I had borderline personality disorder when there was a friend of mine who, you know, I considered a good friend at the time. When I had a panic attack, because I do suffer from anxiety, and basically, long story short, I had a concussion and it basically spewed on some like sort of anxiety and like anxiety attacks. And I was in the street in Colombia and I called them and I was like, hey, I really need some help. Like, please come and get me. I have, you know, terrible anxiety right now. And they just didn't come and help me because they were busy. And I think, yeah, okay, that kind of makes you a bit of like a bad friend, but somebody who doesn't have borderline personality disorder might be like, oh, I can forgive them eventually. But for me, my boundaries are so fierce. And I'm like, if you hurt me, I take that so personally. It takes me ages to get over things. And I used to see that as a weakness, but actually, this is the sort of like compartmentalizing and compressing everything I'm saying about this. But I actually realized that so much of why I consider myself, I would even go say like an empathetic or inclusive or thoughtful climate activist is because of the things that characterize my borderline personality disorder. The things that make me sensitive, the things that make me care, they're the things that really make me want to fight for other people and also fight for this planet and fight for other beings as well. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's really powerful. What would be some advice you would give someone who wants to be like a better ally to someone who does suffer from like different mental health issues?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, everyone's at different stages of their journey when they identify with different mental health conditions. And, you know, if I were to think of an ally that was supporting me in my mental health journey right now, I think listening is one of the best things that you can do, and not invalidating somebody's emotions or feelings. You know, like mm-hmm. There's so much of that, I think, that does happen, intentional or not. And when I have been supported, it's been through people who say, like, you're valid, like, your feelings are valid, you know, your childhood traumas are valid, your, you know, validation is really important, but also giving a space to listen. And I think it's also really, really important to ask somebody who's suffering from mental health conditions what you can do to assist them. Because a lot of the time, I think people think it's as simple as just listening. But if you're in a position of privilege as like a, you know, a quote unquote normal mental person, then, you know, you have capacity potentially to help somebody who's struggling at the moment, and to make sure that their, you know, journey or recovery is comfortable and swift.
Mm-hmm. A lot of climate activism work is obviously very emotionally draining. Mm-hmm. So how do you safeguard your mental health while participating in the work that you do? And how do you set these boundaries?
Don't do it very well, to be honest. To be very, very honest. And this is the thing, right? I really love this question, because it's something that I want to work on. And it's something that I'm far from perfect on. And I think so many activists struggle with this like work-life balance. And that is, I guess, where I can say that borderline personality disorder can be quite detrimental, because you really struggle to separate like this idea of work and personal life balance. Like, I take everything so personally that, you know, it might just be something that I really do need to draw these boundaries, and I need to find a way that works for me. However, that being said, you know, we spoke about boundaries, and I've been very clear online about how I do take these things personally. And it's something I want to work on, and it's something that I'm trying to work on to make sure that I can manage this balance a bit easier. But if you can inform people that it's something you struggle with, and they can be mindful of that, then that's great. And like, you know, I would say that the majority of people I interact with online are really lovely people. And if I say, hey, I don't have the time or the capacity to respond to your message right now or explain something to you, most people are like, oh shit, yeah, I completely get it. Thank you for letting me know. And that's something that's really helped me. But also with regards to kind of the effect of the mental like weight of the climate crisis, and especially with some of the advocacy work that I do, I would say one of the best things that has helped me tremendously is finding a community of people who really support the work that I do and who lift me higher. And, you know, a few of my friends are very active on social media in their anti-racism work and their climate activism. One of my friends in particular has, you know, really had to think about boundaries more and more these days, because her following has gone up so much since talking about this. And like, rightly so, her work is amazing. And just hearing her talk about her boundaries and hearing her talk about how she manages this kind of stuff, and hearing her and other people be really supportive when I'm struggling with the kind of weight of this work, has been so nice. And there are people out there who will support you and support your work and see the validation and the importance of what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So with growing up in Hong Kong, and I guess being in a family that embodies Asian culture as well, mental health is relatively stigmatized as compared to places like in the Western world. Mm-hmm. So how have you been able to navigate this, or how are you navigating this?
I love that question, because it's so hard. And I mean, it's not perfect. My parents are... they're quite hands-off people when it comes to my life. Like, I moved to the UK and you know, we speak on occasion, but we're not massively close. So I think I navigate a lot of this by myself. But when I realized that I had depression when I was about 17, bearing in mind, I was probably depressed for the majority of my life in high school. People would never be able to tell though, because I was so bubbly and so hyper, and like, I did really well in school, and that was something that you know, were the hallmarks of someone who was happy. But towards the end of my high school career, I was really depressed. Like I really felt lost, and my parents didn't support me so much. But when I got to university, I finally got diagnosed with depression, and the sort of typical thing that doctors do is they prescribe you antidepressants. And I remember the first time I got prescribed antidepressants, and my mum found them, and such like a typical thing that my mum says. She just saw the antidepressants. She's like, this is not going to help you. Your auntie had this before, and like, it just made her fat, and we don't want you to get fat. No. So like, don't take them. And she was just like, I'm going to throw these away. And I was like, oh my God. Oh, no. Yeah. So like, you know, she was just such a typical thing my mom would do, thinking that like her way of supporting me is by telling me not to get fat. I'm just like, what? What? And then, you know, as different diagnoses have kind of come and gone, my parents have been listening a bit more, and they've actually done some reading. And I remember I got diagnosed with premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which means that like 2 weeks before my period, my mood drops, and like I get really hormonal. And it fluctuates. It's not always like as bad as it sounds. But, you know, my mom actually did some reading about a premenstrual dysphoric disorder, like blog post or something that was in Cantonese. And because her English, you know, like it's not her first language, and her Cantonese is so much better. And when I saw her doing that, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is huge. Like it's really, really a big step. And she's like, I'm sorry, I just don't understand. Like I'm trying to understand. And then I told her I had borderline personality disorder. And, you know, I sent my parents a message, and I was like, hey, you know, this is something I'm really struggling with, and I'd really appreciate you reading these resources. So I sent them all the resources, and my dad just said, okay, I'll read them. And then my mom just said, make sure you don't tell your friends because you won't get a job. And I was like, oh my God. He was like, yes, I'll read them. Make sure you don't tell your friends. I'm like, oh my God, so close, but so far.
Yeah, it's so funny to like hear how the different way in which I guess their love is communicated.
Yeah,
because I mean, like, them sending articles and reading articles is like a huge step already.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it means a lot.
It does. This is the thing, you know, it really hurts when I think from a like sort of Western perspective of like what my friends have gone through with regards to their mental health, and the sort of Western sort of accommodation for mental health conditions. People are like, you're valid, and say all these wonderful things, and it's really healing. And then, you know, I'm kind of dealt the other hand with my parents kind of saying things like, okay, I'll read an article, and it's just like, oh my God, this is huge, you know. And you become accustomed to this sort of Westernized way of dealing with mental health conditions, that like it hurts when they don't do what you expect of them.
Yeah,
but at the
sure.
same time, everyone that I know from Hong Kong, or any friends who have like Asian parents, or people who, you know, don't necessarily understand mental health conditions, we kind of like joke about it. And that's really healing as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there is such a cultural divide between how people in the East think versus how people in the West think. And I think that sometimes we say this is good or this is bad, and it's not as simple as that. It's just different. And I do think that perceptions of mental health in Hong Kong need to change, because, you know, I've had a lot of friends who have really, really struggled with getting the correct diagnoses or getting support from their families. And so in many respects, yes, it's been tough, but it's also taught me to be more independent, and it means that I can manage my health like on my own, which is, yeah, is not ideal, but it's helpful.
Yeah, for sure. I read something about how in a lot of places in China, mental health or like depression isn't diagnosed as a mental health issue, but like a physical thing, because they just refuse to acknowledge that you can have problems with like your mental side.
Oh my gosh, that is wow.
And then yeah, so it's just like underreported, and then the statistics are completely ignoring the fact that people do suffer from depression.
To be honest, that kind of sounds very much like the way that my mom sees depression, because she's just like, oh, when you get depressed, you get fat. And I'm just like, okay, mom, thanks for your input. I learned so much.
Yeah.
But yeah, also one more thing I want to say is that like, I completely do empathize in many respects with my parents because I think they suffer from depression. I definitely think my mom has some form of mental health condition that is undiagnosed. Like just the way she communicates, she really struggles to express her emotions and she really struggles with maintaining her mood. And, you know, a large part of these things are inherited. So I wouldn't be surprised if my mom had conditions, but she's never had the validation and support from her own parents and from her own generation or from my father. So how could I expect her to empathize with what I'm going through if she's going through something but refuses to acknowledge or doesn't have the resources to acknowledge that she's depressed or that she's unhappy or that she's got something, you know? So
yeah, for sure. So how do you think being in Hong Kong and in Bristol, how is the community response to climate change different? Or like in what ways is it different?
It's so interesting saying that because I haven't been in Hong Kong for a while. And I can't really gauge what the climate movement there is like. But I definitely can imagine that there's a lot of hype around school striking. I can imagine that. And I have seen some different like groups emerging with regards to the school strikes in Hong Kong, like Fridays for Future. So I would say that, you know, there is definitely a presence now that wasn't necessarily as strong when I grew up in Hong Kong. Bristol is like the home of climate activism in the UK, alongside London, I guess. It's where Extinction Rebellion was founded. We also have a lot of like very, very progressive people here who indulge in activism, not indulge in activism, but like, you know, pioneer activist spheres. And, you know, it has a very rich history of different forms of justice activism that, you know, I have learned more and more about. But, you know, that's not to say this stuff doesn't exist in Hong Kong because being in the UK, perhaps even as someone who really identifies with, you know, being quite a, I guess, expressive English speaker, I can recognize and learn about the history more here than, say, in Hong Kong. And, you know, there's obviously like this dual, or maybe even try these days, culture of Hong Kong with like the British and with Cantonese people as well. And, you know, segregation and colonial history. There's got to be a lot there that I still need to unpack, and I'm trying to learn more. And climate activism isn't just about the environmental movement. There's a lot of it which is political, a lot of it which is social, you know, to do with feminism, to do with, you know, racial equality as well. And that's something that I still need to delve into more in Hong Kong. But I also realized that, like, even though the UK's political system sucks, if you're a Hong Konger and you're experiencing what they're experiencing right now and what has been happening, especially with regards to the protests, your priority probably isn't going to be talking about the climate crisis. Some people definitely will try to, but, you know, if your own governmental system isn't working, it's almost a privilege to talk about the climate crisis as a thing in many respects. Not strictly, but in some ways.
Yeah, no, for sure. I guess building on that, what do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions or myths when it comes to climate activism?
I think a lot of people have this idea of climate activists being perfect, and that's maybe more of a forced perception. Look, we're very, very quick to criticize climate activists for not being completely zero waste, or people who aren't vegan, or people who still fly, or people who, you know, have a history of like not necessarily being environmentally friendly. We're very, very quick to criticize. And I think sometimes that can be very counterproductive. It is important to call out people if they're, you know, promoting things that kind of go against what they're trying to strive for. But we also have to be mindful that this is a journey and you can't be perfect in an imperfect system. It's just impossible. So it's a really, really delicate balance. I think also there's a misconception with climate activism being all about striking. A lot of people think that if you're somebody who strikes, then that's a quintessential climate activist. If you do what Greta Thunberg does, or if you do what, you know, like that's what people think climate activism is. And that's why it's really dangerous that the climate sphere is very homogenized by white people and very homogenized by European people in particular, because climate activism is actually, you know, something that has been championed by people of color all around the world who are fighting for their rights. And racial justice is a huge, huge, huge facet of climate justice. And, you know, I think that the most dangerous misconception when we idealize people like Greta and we don't pay any attention to other climate activists who have unique perspectives and unique experiences, and also people who unfortunately are going to be hit hardest by the climate crisis. So I would say that's probably one of the most dangerous perceptions of climate activists. And I think the other thing that can be quite dangerous is that it's funny, it can be dangerous, but it's also really good for the movement, that climate activists are kind of like figures and celebrities now. It's good for the movement in that it maybe makes this form of activism more mainstream, so people want to get involved, but then also dangerous because we pit climate activists, much like celebrities are, to these super high standards that are really, really emotionally draining. And climate activism as it stands is emotionally draining, alongside having a public profile. That's got to be like even more exhausting. So yeah,
no, I think it's really interesting because I guess your podcast is called The Bad Activist, so it's about like how you don't have to be perfect, and then mine is also like involves the word activist, about how you don't necessarily have to be like a frontline activist who's constantly engaged with protesting. So I guess there are like similarities there. So I want to ask, how do you define an activist, and what does it mean to be an activist to you?
I think to have a conscience of the things that are going on around you, and I think using your voice, whatever your voice may be, because obviously that sounds a bit ableist, but like your ability to express these things or to relay this information and to advocate for change that is, you know, going against the grain of what society tries to implement. I think that to me is activism. But one of the things that my friend Julia said, which I do agree with to some extent, but I also feel like activism is a journey, is she said that you're an activist once you start moving from like individual change to system change. And I think that while I would agree that system change is something that as a more seasoned activist I'm thinking about, I would also want to like not discourage people from, you know, being part of this activist journey by saying, you know, you can't be an activist unless you're like tackling system change, because there are individual things that we can do which can be very empowering. And if you're sharing your individual changes, you can inspire so many people. And like that is a collective change which can lead to system change. So I think that for me, it's a very nuanced thing between like realizing that you have a conscience and you can do individual things to use your voice in different ways, but also realizing that this can be something that you develop over time and becomes more about system change once you've kind of almost like ticked those boxes of adjusting your individual behaviors in line with what you would consider conscious or like better.
Yeah, I definitely feel like everyone begins with like a zero waste phase. That's how everyone kickstarts their like environment sustainability journey, and then you sort of go down this rabbit hole where you start learning about like the root of the problem and like how you can get more involved with system change. Which I think is really interesting because it's a good starting point,
a lot more accessible, I think, you know.
Yeah, for sure. So what is your typical tactic for mobilizing people to care about climate change?
You know, I mentioned direct action before, and previously that was a really good way of mobilizing people because you're working as a collective, and often when you're one person alone, it can be really difficult to mobilize people to talk about climate change. But I do also want to like just say that as an individual, you can make a huge difference regardless of whether you're part of a direct action group, regardless of whether you protest. I think that galvanizing people to make changes, to speak to them on a level that is perhaps relatable, but also isn't afraid to speak about things that are quite ugly in many respects, and I was reading a collection of essays from Audre Lorde last night, who's a Black civil rights activist. And one of the things that she said was, you know, a lot of the activism that I do is not new. I just think of new ways to reinvent it and to communicate it better or to communicate it in a different way. And that for me really, really resonated because, you know, there are people who have been speaking about things long before I was born, people who have been fighting on the front lines long before I started talking about climate activism. But all I can do is, when I learn from somebody, try and adapt that and make it accessible in a way that I can communicate and, you know, make people more aware. And I would say that these days I'm learning a lot from Black civil rights activists. I'm learning a lot from Indigenous communities who do a lot of activism on the front lines, and finding a way of communicating their stories, but also, you know, almost, I don't want to say it's not co-opting, because co-opting just makes it sound like you steal someone's form of activism and you brand it your own, but learning from these forms of activism and trying to communicate your words through a similar sort of lens that is really powerful, that can be extremely helpful. And social media has been really good for that, for me at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because everyone, even if you're relaying the same message, everyone has a slightly different perspective just because of their upbringing and their profile. And so, yeah, it's interesting how you can say the same message but convey it in such a different way.
Yes,
and like sure. Reach different audiences.
For sure. Yeah, it's very much an individualistic thing. But yeah, like I said before, you can also work in conjunction with other people and amplify each other and hold each other accountable. That's another thing. I love being held accountable. It's such an uncomfortable thing, but it makes me so much better an activist and makes me a lot more happy and a lot more conscious.
Mm-hmm. So what are three or more or less qualities you find most valuable in any advocacy work?
I think that I guess it really depends on the person, but for me, one of the things that I have really, really employed or tried to be conscious of with my activism is acknowledging the people who came before you and acknowledging your privilege. Because I think when you start to deconstruct your privilege and you start to think about, you know, how it is perhaps your responsibility to talk about this, or perhaps how you can assist and ally with other people because of the work that they've done before, that for me has made me a much better activist. I would also say that, I don't know if being fearless is the right word I'm looking for, but I would consider myself very outspoken. I'm not afraid of speaking my mind, and I never have been. And if that pisses people off, I really urge people to think, okay, why are you more preoccupied with something that has pissed you off than what I'm talking about, you know? And for me, being fearless is something that may or may not turn people away. I think it depends on what state you're in, but I always try and maintain that if I'm speaking about something that makes people feel uncomfortable or make people feel, you know, like they don't get it, or it's too strong or it's not palatable, I always try and maintain, like, why does that make you feel uncomfortable? What can you do to acknowledge these things that I'm talking about? What is it that, you know, deeply irks you about what I'm saying? Is it because you know it's true? Is it because you're not at that stage in your journey yet? You know, like, I think being fearless is something that is really important to me. And I think another thing that I would kind of say in regards to the former two is having a lot of introspection. I'm a very deep thinker. It's kind of obvious. And I think that being introspective is also being accountable. And being accountable for what you do is very important. You know, I would say that a lot of climate activists are very humble people in many regards, not necessarily in the traditional sense of the word, but in terms of how they think about their behavior and how they, as I mentioned, recognize their privilege and how they affect other people or how they communicate something. And I think that's one of the most important things, is to think about what you're doing, think about how you feel, think about what you want to do moving forward. You know, I think that's, yeah, it's really important for me.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess on the other hand, what is something that angers you the most when it comes to environmental issues or even the general response to these environmental issues?
I mean, I would say previously and probably still, things that infuriated me were just feeling like I was alone in speaking about these things, kind of being like, do you not realize what's happening? Do you not realize like this affects you too? That is something that used to infuriate me quite a lot and is still at the back of my mind. But now I'm also thinking, like, do you not realize how this affects other people? Do you not realize there are people who are going to be very severely affected by the climate crisis? And what are you doing to be part of that conversation? That was something that really upset me multiple times, because I'm like, do people not have empathy? Like, when I think about communities who are literally, you know, like, their homes are going to disappear. What? Like, it's horrible to think about that. But then I also remember that, like, one of the things I pride myself on is feeling emotional and empathetic and sensitive to these kinds of things. So, you know, maybe that's where it comes into play. But then also, I get frustrated when the environmental movement isn't inclusive. I get frustrated when people in positions of power do not use their platforms to, you know, talk about issues that are extremely important. Like recently, you know, myself and a few friends called out this very influential climate activist who has kind of been the face of XR for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it came from a place of like, we admire the fact you talk about climate activism, but you can do so much more. And like, you have an amazing resource and platform here, so use it. And their response, or rather their way of tackling this, mm-hmm. was by deleting my friend's comment, by freaking out, by like, you know, and this is a really privileged white male who did this like act of protesting against the petroleum conference and got arrested for it. And mm-hmm. I was just like,
oh yeah,
great that you did that. Yeah, it's great that you did that. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, it's great that you did that, but you do realize that you're extremely wealthy. Mm-hmm. You do not have a family to feed. You're not somebody who, if you get arrested, that doesn't mean it's the end of your life. And I was just thinking, had that been a black man who had been arrested, would they have been let off so easily? Because said person has a huge Instagram following. Said person is a celebrity mm-hmm. of sorts. You know, like, it's always admirable, of course, when people do things for the environment, but we also have to realize that, like, we are privileged if we don't have to worry about our safety. And it's so important to have these conversations, because it almost feels infuriating when so-called person gets all the attention for the activism they do, whereas my friends who live in Colombia from indigenous communities, like, their people have been, you know, attacked or murdered when they talk about, you know, climate issues. So, and it's not to say that it should prevent you from doing any form of activism, but again, this idea of introspection, you know, if you feel attacked, if you feel like you're sad because you did something wrong, then what are you going to do moving forward? And I mean, you know, I saw that this person apologized to one of my friends who they didn't treat with respect, and I appreciate that. But, you know, I also heard that this person lied about the fact that they deleted my friend's comment, or, you know, like, they acted out so badly when they were called out. They blocked and deleted my friend, mm-hmm. and then they, you know, they kind of spoke to some people within our sphere and said, oh, I never did that. And it's like, why, you know?
Yeah.
How fragile are you if you can't acknowledge that you have privilege?
Yeah.
Their platform has been eerily quiet. I mean, if you have 1.5 million followers, I would hope that you'd be able to talk up climate activism and people on the front lines a lot more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's such an important part of, like, growing as an activist, is being able to own up to any mistakes you made and, like, recognizing how you can build off of that. I think it all just boils down to listening as well, which is such an important quality when it comes to climate activism.
Definitely. And, you know, I just kind of want to say as well, it's not comfortable and it will never be comfortable. And this is the thing, you know, when you see articles that say we have like 6 months before, you know, we have a point of no return. And, you know, when you see the Black civil rights movement as well, and people are literally going about their lives thinking that they can just be constantly comfortable in their activism work, I get it. It's really tough. It's really, really, really tough. And it's a horrible feeling to feel called out, but we have to stop, you know, saying that this is something that is harmful or makes us sad or whatever. Like, if you're called out, you're in a position of privilege. It's as simple as that. And I've been called out so many times. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful every time somebody does. And it made me so much more a better activist. Mm-hmm. And it's given me the confidence as well to say, hey, I fucked up. Like, it's okay if you fuck up. Just like listen and amend your behavior and move on.
Mm-hmm. What are some things that you've been called out for?
So I've been called out before for essentially, you know, making my activism not as inclusive. And this one's kind of a subtle one. It's not necessarily because I've said anything, but it's because of the way that I communicated climate activism. Like, I talked only about environmental stuff. And this calling out wasn't so like open or so, it wasn't as like strict. It was me joining Sail for Climate Action as a project. And I realized that when my friends were talking about like racial inequality, I was like, oh shit, I don't talk about this enough. I need to. And climate justice is racial justice. So that one's a more subtle one that I've not been explicitly called out on, but like upon doing that, it's made me more aware of like where I've gone wrong and when people were being kind of like, hint, hint, this isn't so like inclusive. That's actually like a very soft way of calling me out. And another thing I was called out on was one of my friends is Colombian. And, you know, I had posted on my stories a few months ago. I was running in Cartagena and it was like really early in the morning. And there was this guy who was just like harassing me to buy drugs. And like, they have a really large coke problem in Cartagena because of the tourism there. And it was obvious, like as a half Chinese woman, like I stick out like a sore thumb. I'm not from Colombia. And he's harassing me to buy some cocaine. And I was just like, no, senor, like, no. And he kept harassing me. And I posted about it on my stories. And I was just like, just got harassed for drugs again. Welcome to Colombia. And Colombia has a really rich history of so much more than its drug history. And I realized that like, that's really hurtful to people in Colombia who are trying to be more than their drug history, mm-hmm. especially in the West where we glamorize their drug history. It's terrible. Like you think about like shows like Narcos and the way that people talk about cocaine and like all of these Vice documentaries, which are so, you know, deep and harrowing, but people find it glamorous. We need to be mindful of that. And my friend said, you know, I have always tried to be more than a Colombian who talks about their drug history, but we have to be mindful that our country is so much more than that. And I know you didn't mean to stereotype and you're clearly like pissed off about being harassed for drugs. And it was so wrong of me. And the problematic thing I find is that when I apologize for this, so many of my Colombian friends were just like, I don't find it offensive. This is not offensive. It is a huge problem. Like Colombia has a big problem. And I was like, it doesn't matter if you don't find it offensive. Someone from Colombia finds it offensive and is like trying to shed this stereotype and trying to prevent her country from being homogenized about its drug culture, then I have to be responsible and I take full responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the more recent things. But it's funny because I don't remember posting it at all. But she made me aware of it from like months ago. And I was just like, you're so right. Like, this is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the most recent thing. And I call myself out a lot. Like, I found myself using the words lame, which is associated with like physical disability. And it's not good to describe something as like lame if it's not really what it's intended to mean. Mm-hmm. And what else? I use the word savage. Like, savage is a really popular colloquial thing that people say in the UK.
Yeah.
Like, if you're savage, you're like, you know, if someone disrespects you or says a mean joke, you can call that person savage. Like, oh, that was so, like, you know, hurtful, but in like a jokey kind mm-hmm. of way. But savage has been co-opted for Buddhist culture when it was initially used to describe Native American people when white, colonialists came over from Europe to the United States and, you know, would use that word to justify killing lots of Native Americans. So it's something I'm mindful of. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I heard about that recently, actually. And it's just really, I guess, problematic because one of the most popular, like, trending TikTok songs right now is Savage.
Yes,
yeah, and I don't think that's, yeah, people probably aren't aware of that. So maybe if someone made a TikTok with that song,
yeah,
dispelling what it actually means, that'd be an interesting.
It's so hard because, yeah, I feel like it's a really difficult thing to navigate because, you know, language does change and marginalized communities can reclaim certain words that have been previously offensive. So, you know, I don't know if you saw, but when Black Lives Matter was kind of being protested, somebody made a poster that said Yellow Peril for Black Power. And Yellow Peril is a very, very racist term. And it's something, I'm actually reading about Yellow Peril at the moment. And it's essentially this like perpetuated fear from the West of Far East people. And, you know, obviously this horrible slur yellow to describe people of East Asian descent. And Yellow Peril was kind of used to capitalize this fear of East Asian people, their culture, portraying them to be evil and like manipulative and, you know, Yellow Peril, that's where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And this person kind of tried to reclaim this phrase to say, you know, that East Asian communities support Black Lives Matter.
Okay.
But a lot of people said, hey, it's just not there yet. Like Yellow Peril is still a very disrespectful term to the Asian community. It is still rooted in racism. And at what point as society do we choose to reclaim words in the context of Savage, like a white person reclaiming that as something which is like not offensive, to me doesn't count as reclaiming because it's not done by the people who it was intended to oppress in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the same with like, I was speaking about the fox eye trend.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as well.
Yeah, like white women are trying to pull their eyes to make their eyes like appear sort of more slanted. And like, that is the kind of shit that I used to receive on the playground from like white people. I've had my eyes, like people pull their eyes at me as a slur in the UK as well. And if a white person is trying to reclaim that as a beauty look, it just doesn't like authentic or appropriate reclamation.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it was an Asian person trying to accentuate the slants of their eyes and like, you know, show that Asian eyes are beautiful as well, then I would perhaps be like, okay, let's have a discussion about this. Is this actually reclamation? Is this not offensive? Like, is that something we can talk about? But if it's a white woman, like, you know, Kylie Jenner or Bella Hadid pulling their eyes because they think it makes them look more beautiful, but it's actually a huge like racial slur that has been, you know, used against a lot of East Asian people,
mm-hmm.
then I'm not gonna argue. Like, I'm just like, no, this is wrong. Like, it is, no, there's no, yeah, navigating that. It's just wrong.
Yeah, like, it definitely has to come from the people, like, the acceptance of it has to come from the people who have been
yes.
on the receiving end of it. Otherwise, it's not the same process.
Definitely. And I can't remember where this was, where this was said. It was on a TV show and my friend was talking about it. And, you know, the white host or whatever was asking a question to this black man and said, why can't white people say N-word? You guys say N-word all the time. Like, it's a, you know, it's a racist phrase and you use it. And then the black man's response was like, go on then, say it. Say it. And he was just silent. And it just goes to show that like, you as a white person cannot decide what is racist if it's a like a term that you created that has been sort of used within the communities that you were trying to oppress, and they're trying to reclaim a word because it like signifies like a sort of power that they have. So yeah, it got me really thinking about all of these different complexities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like when it comes to using racial slurs, it's so much easier to just not have it in your vocabulary. Like, I think the amount of damage it would cause to the communities who are affected by it would be so much more drastic than just having to remove it from like your sentence.
Definitely, completely. I mean, you know, when we look at the dictionary, I think we have like, I don't know how many words we have, but it's like over 350,000 the last time I was reading about this. And there are so many words that you can use, you know,
Yeah,
like
and they're
you
not
don't
like
have to.
essential either.
Exactly.
Yeah,
We just have to train ourselves or unlearn certain words and like get them out of our habit and our vocabulary. And it seems pedantic. Like I think this is one of the other things that I used to struggle with was I was like, am I just being too paranoid about this? Am I just being too quote unquote woke? And I've been called woke in a condescending way before. People say, oh, like you're just trying to be woke. And I'm just like, no, I'm just trying to be a decent human being because if somebody tells me something offends them, then I'm gonna listen. And like these microaggressions, as they're called, do add up. They really do add up and they invalidate the struggles of people who feel them. Like, you know, as a mixed woman, I'm not immune to racial inequality and racial struggle. I have mentioned I've had eyes pulled at me before. I've had the word like the C word thrown at me multiple times in the UK. My mom has been attacked in the UK before. Like when we were in Oxford, there were Romani people who were passing through town and they like verbally and physically attacked. And people don't seem to realize that the culture of microaggressions adds up to normalize physical violence. Like it's not as simple as delineating, oh, well, these are just words that are, you know, harmless. No, they add up over time. And when people realize they're offensive, it really, really affects the mental health of marginalized people and people of color as well. You know, like if you were called the C word continuously by people as a joke every single day, it would get to the point where it'd like genuinely be really, really bad on your mental health. Not even having it said multiple times, but like even once, you know. It's a racist term, and people should feel free to defend themselves and say, no, that's not okay, and please do better as an ally. So, yeah, I people calling me woke or like calling me too sensitive or like just get over it and stuff, that's gaslighting. It's gaslighting 101. And once you recognize it, you like can't ignore it.
Yeah, I saw that you posted on your story. There was that one guy who commented on your FoxEye post
Oh my
who
gosh.
just refused to acknowledge the significance of the whole
He was so
situation.
problematic. Yeah. He basically started by calling himself a full
Oh,
Asian.
yeah.
And I was like, okay, don't get me wrong. I know there are hardships that people who come from East Asian descent, like, you know, who are quote unquote full Asian experience. But we have to start acknowledging that you can't just say somebody is full Asian or half Asian. Like, I still experience the hardships that you've faced. If anything, in many respects, and I want to talk about this in a podcast about the Eurasian experience. If anything, the fact that I'm half white means people see it as more of an invitation to use these slurs against me because it's funny to them. You know, it's like, hey, you're one of our own because you're half white, so I can say this shit to you. And it's like, no, you know, my ex-boyfriend is a perfect example of that. He would never do this if I was fully Asian, quote unquote. You know, as a joke, he was just like, and he was white, okay? So he was, when I met his friends for the first time, he was like, oh, it'd be so funny if you just started bowing and not speaking English and speaking with like a Ching Chong accent. And I was like, what the fuck, man? Like, and because I'm half white, people think,
That
oh,
it's
they're not going to
okay.
take it as seriously, you know? So we need to move away from this idea of like being full Asian or whatever. Like there are unique experiences to being Eurasian that I think people don't necessarily take as seriously. And straddling a middle ground is very confusing. So that was the first issue I had. And he proceeded to be like, you'll never understand what racism I go through and stuff like this. And I was like, yeah, maybe I'll never fully understand, but that does not mean that I don't advocate for racial equality for my East Asian community. Like he was just like, you're fixating on the fox eye trend. Are you talking about yellow face? Are you talking about, and I'm like, dude, I have spoken about this stuff so much. Just because you speak about one thing that you deem unimportant doesn't mean that I'm not speaking about this kind of stuff. You know, I've spoken about the model minority myth. I'm going to be delving into Kim's racial triangulation theory. I'm going to be talking about like COVID-19 racial inequality. And I've spoken about that stuff on my stories. People always use this line of defense when they see you talking about something that they deem unimportant. They use that as an excuse to weaponize like you not doing enough. And this is something that a lot of climate activists feel as well. It's this idea of armchair activists coming in their space and telling them they're not doing good enough. And it's literally like 99% of the time, the people who criticize are the people who do nothing at all, like literally nothing. So he was a classic example of an armchair activist. And another thing that I really, really encourage everybody to go read about is this idea of DARPA. So there's this amazing racial anti-racism coach called Rachel Cargo. Who speaks about this a lot. And DARPA is essentially, it's an acronym used to describe like the strategy that abusers use. So, you know, racial abusers in particular. It's a specific form of gaslighting. So it will deny that the abuse ever took place. It will then attack the victim for attempting to hold the abuser accountable. And then this person will then lie and claim that they, the abuser, are the real victim of the situation, thus reversing the victim and offender. So this guy was using this classic example of DARPA where he was like, as a full Asian, you will never understand what abuse I go through. So it's reversing this idea of victim and offender, and it's denying the abuse. So he denied that it was something that was abusive. And then he proceeded to attack me by calling me woke and trying to say that like, you need to be held accountable, you know? So it's like, it's so recognizable. Once you start engaging in anti-racism work and realizing things like DARPA, you can recognize and tear down people who are just like being so problematic.
Yeah. No, that's really frustrating. But I'm glad that like you're able to handle these things.
Yeah. It takes practice. And I mean, like, he pissed me off.
I was
just like, oh man, come on. Like, we're part of the same team here. Like, what are you trying to do right now?
Yeah, no, but I'm excited to listen to that, your episode about growing up Eurasian, because I think there are definitely a lot of struggles of being Eurasian that aren't covered a lot just because it's not like a as common experience that's discussed.
Oh my gosh, completely. And like, I really appreciate that. One of the things that I think is very, very prominent about the Eurasian experience is feeling like you don't identify with either or. Your Chinese family doesn't fully accept you as Chinese. Your English family doesn't fully accept you as English. You always feel kind of out of place. And, you know, this guy was a classic example of East Asian community saying, you're not fully this, so you aren't part of our community. And it's very exclusionary. And I think there's a lot of uniqueness to being Eurasian that has hardships and has benefits as well. And I think that also goes with being East Asian compared to like being Black, for instance. You know, we live in a society where anti-Blackness is rife, and there is also a lot of harm in saying that as well with the model minority myth. So yeah, I definitely want to like unpack that, and there's so much I can say, especially like drawing in from my own experiences and the experiences of my mixed friends as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was watching this video from this girl who's half Indian, half British, living in the UK, and she's talking about how there's so many like different microaggressions that they experience from being mixed race, and like one of them even being just how you'll be walking around with one of your parents and people don't like accept that you guys are related, like they'll always deny the fact that you're a family just because you don't look exactly like one of your parents. And I thought that was really interesting.
That is so true. And like, I was a blonde baby and nobody thought that my mom was my mom, you know. People looked at my brother. My brother has dark hair. He definitely looks a lot more Cantonese than I do. I had like sort of green eyes and blonde hair growing up, so people were like, huh, is that really your daughter? And you know, that would happen all the time. And I also really think that there is this horrible thing that people do when you're Eurasian where like because you're mixed, it's seen as like, oh, I only have a little bit of Asian that, you know, makes you kind of exotic, which is both racist towards people who are like from East Asian communities and people who identify as being Eurasian, because it implies that like, if you're half white, that's like a good mix, you know, like you've got a little bit of the white, you've got a little bit of the Asian in you as well, and therefore you're more palatable. But then they also use that as a reason to think that you are more sexually desirable, or like use these horrible, you know, like slurs. I've been called exotic or oriental, or, you know, people have always said I'm kind of like, they liken me to so many different like Asian people who are considered like, you know, more Western looking, and saying, oh, you look like this person, or you look like this person. And it's just some random ass like mixed person that I've never even heard of before. People think we all look the same, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm just like, oh my God.
I don't know if you saw this post, but there was like, it was a pretty disgusting post of like people attending a BLM protest, and someone had a sign that said, stop killing black people, I want mixed babies. And it's just like this fetishization of mixed race people, and like, I don't know. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot. Like, I used to date this person who was very infatuated with the idea that I was half Chinese, and like, I just find that men can be so gross sometimes. They're just like, oh yeah, like the babies that we'll have will be really cool. Just like, mate, piss off. Like, seriously, first of all, I don't want to have my own biological children. Secondly, no, if you like me just because I'm mixed, then please leave. And I mean, safe to say it didn't work out, right? So yeah, that is, I saw that as well, fetishization of the culture, because you want to you want to like have it as a collectible.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of white people in particular, they like to think of Asian women, regardless of whether you're Eurasian or full Asian, I'm going to say that as a tongue-in-cheek thing these days, full Asian, they like sort of perpetuate this idea of like Asian women as docile and submissive and like collectibles, which I think is really toxic.
Yeah, it's almost like colonization in a relationship.
Oh my gosh, decolonize your relationship. I'm definitely gonna quote you on that, because that was fantastic. Literally, I feel like white people colonize their relationships.
Oh yeah, for sure. Okay. Moving on.
Yeah,
so what would your vision for the future be, I guess, both personally and for society moving forward? Yeah.
It's funny, because even though I talk about a lot of negative things, I like to think optimistically. I do have hope. I like to imagine a utopia where it's inclusive, and like our cultures are decolonized, and we have a just transition of like championing green economy, and, you know, reimagining a system that doesn't necessarily rest on the so-called laurels of capitalism. I know that people say that you can change capitalism in a way that makes it work and talk about circular economy, but that is a deviation from what's normal. I'm not a financial expert. I'm not somebody who's an expert in policy or like society, but I do think that I do think that we need to be mindful of like these different systems that try and combat oppression and move towards a system which is not as oppressive and is more inclusive, and really truly champions the term sustainability. And yeah, I think for me that is kind of how I would like to imagine the future. But also, I mentioned I'm not an expert. For myself, I just like my journey of unlearning to continue. I would like to get to a point where I feel as though the platform that I'm creating can be used to amplify other people and messages that are important. I would like to get to a point where this is a job that I do, and I'm starting to like tread this very hazy ground at the moment where people are asking me to do certain jobs for money, and the majority of the time I say no because I don't think it's like in line with my ethos. But I do want to monetize this in a way and use that money that I get to pay it forward and to like be part of a system where wealth and power are redistributed. So yeah, kind of intertwined.
So currently, what do you do when you're not engaged with environmental activism, or is everything you do sort of like basic?
A lot of it is very, very interlinked. I seem to have a very like strange working / living lifestyle where I don't necessarily like intertwine things in a way that can be separated. I feel as though if I'm like winding down or if I'm not doing anything related to climate activism, I'm still thinking about it. Like I paint, and that's something that it's really funny. My art teacher in school, like when I was doing my like I think year 9 is the last time I did art, she was like, "You're a really terrible artist." I was like, "Okay." And I started picking up a paintbrush, and then I was like, "Hey, this actually doesn't look so bad." Mm-hmm. And I've sold paintings before, and you know, I've done painting for fun, and I think it's something I use to wind down, but then I'm also just like, how can I raise money for a specific charity? Like, can I paint something that says something about the climate crisis? It just becomes every fiber of your being.
Yeah.
Like, even when I'm watching shows, like I posted a while ago that I was watching 13 Reasons Why, and I have so many feelings about that show. It's so problematic. And, you know, I was just like, oh, I'll just watch it because, you know, it's recommended on Netflix. And then I started watching it, and I was like, pen and paper, okay, this is a problem, this is a problem, you know? Netflix, like, I need to just shut off. I think I need to, like, go on holiday, but...
Yeah, not really happening anytime soon. But yeah, I saw some of your climate posters that you painted, and they're really nice. So I think your teacher who said that was clearly, clearly wrong.
Oh, thank you.
So what would be some advice you'd give to activists who want to get more involved with championing like a fight for climate action? And are there any specific resources you would recommend?
Definitely. So one of the things that I think is really, really good is community learning. And I've mentioned direct action before and different action groups. And I think different action groups as well strive to be more inclusive. You know, that protesting isn't the only thing that they do. And I think this is why the coronavirus time is a really transformative one, because it's redefining what activism means, especially on online spheres. Like, we're not necessarily protesting as much. So if you are somebody that wants to get involved, like, if there is a particular organization within your vicinity, within like your local community, that's really, really good to reach out to, but also online. I know that Fridays for Future Digital, you know, are completely volunteer based, and like all of them work together to do these fantastic campaigns where they talk about like different environmental issues, and they're spotlighting Indigenous protectors at the moment. So if that's something you want to help with, it's a really good way to like reach out and get more involved. I can't stress this enough, like 99% of everything that I talk about is based off the teachings and learning from other people. Mm-hmm. So being part of the community is, I'd say, the number one thing that I would recommend.
Are there any specific accounts or pages or videos or like podcasts you would recommend?
Yeah, so I would also just say, like, obviously I'm on Instagram quite a lot, so I use that as a way of learning and sharing information and all of that stuff. If you are somebody that learns that way and you feel like you have the capacity to spend time online, then definitely start diversifying your feed and like following people from different backgrounds, different lines of activism, people from different countries. You know, get involved in the conversation, reach out to these people, start communicating with them. And alongside kind of being active on Instagram, you'll probably come across different platforms and activists. The things I'm really, really loving at the moment, Brown Girl Green is a fantastic collective. It's kind of pioneered by quite a few people within the activist sphere. Like Chrissy definitely is kind of like the face of Brown Girl Green, but then she also does work with other intersectional climate activists. I also really love Queer Brown Vegan. He does some fantastic resources as well. And my friend Michaela is very active on Instagram, and I always learn so much from her. And she and my friend Joe have a podcast called The Yikes Podcast, which I learn a lot from. And they're whoa, it's really windy here. I'm so sorry. Yeah, but I really, really enjoy the Yikes podcast, and I'm learning so much from it. And I constantly like feel as though every time I listen to an episode, I'm like enlightened.
Yeah, no, I also listened to that podcast. That's great. And Isaias, Queer Brown Regan, was actually on the first episode of this podcast. So if anyone wants to listen, that's there as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. I will definitely have a listen to that.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to rate and review the show, because that makes a huge difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out. Also, don't forget to subscribe and stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next Monday.